So yeah, welcome everyone. Welcome back to the Strong Gravity Seminar Series. And it's a really great pleasure to have Masha Okunkova with us today. I hope I pronounced it roughly right, from the CCA, talking about binary black holes beyond general relativity. So please, Masha, take it away.
Hi everyone. Thank you so much for coming and for the invitation to speak. And indeed, today we're going to talk about binary black holes beyond general relativity. And so I do work in the broad field of numerical relativity, which is, you know, solving the equations governing the behavior of space-time on the computer. And I've worked on a variety of projects. So if you see anything here that, you know, piques your interest, feel free to reach out to me. But today we're going to talk about work that I've done on binary black hole mergers beyond general relativity, and then also testing general relativity with gravitational wave observations. So over 100 years ago, we had Albert Einstein give us the Einstein field equations, which are a classical set of equations governing the behavior of space-time. And, you know, for a long time, this was kind of thought to be like the theory that describes the, you know, how the way the cosmos operates. And here we have Chandrasekhar, you know, saying, why do we spend so much time testing GR? We know that the theory is right. However, as stated by Richard Feynman here, like verbatim quote, nature isn't classical. And so at some scale, we need to be able to reconcile this classical theory governing the behavior of space-time with quantum mechanics in a beyond GR theory of gravity. And so one thing that I want to sort of discuss today is this question of, can we observe gravity beyond general relativity? And so let's think about how we can look for extreme gravity. How can we look for gravity at its most extreme, where we could potentially need, you know, this reconciliation of general relativity with quantum mechanics, because we're really in the strong field regime. And so here's a plot from Baker et al, where on the horizontal axis, you have gravitational potential increasing this way. So towards the right is going towards the strong field regime of gravity. And then here on the vertical axis, you have curvature, where going up, you know, you have higher curvatures. And so again, you're reaching the more extreme regime of gravity. We can think about physical systems that we have access to and what regimes they probe in terms of this diagram. So we have here the solar system. And, you know, gravity has been tested a lot within the solar system, but these are kind of comparatively weak field tests. If you then move on to binary pulsar systems, for example, you know, such as the Hulse-Taylor pulsar, you know, these provide for more stringent tests of general relativity, but are still kind of weak field compared to solar mass binary black hole systems and also neutron star systems. So we're kind of lucky enough to be able to probe this regime here. And my claim is that binary black hole systems, I'm going to focus on black holes here, are really our best laboratory for seeing gravity at its most extreme. And so might be our best laboratory for potentially seeing, you know, this breakdown of general relativity and the need to kind of reconcile it with you know, into a quantum theory of gravity. And so, as I said, binary black hole mergers specifically probe the nonlinear, highly dynamical, strong field regime of gravity. Here, for example, is an illustration of space-time curvature for a binary black hole merger. And you can see this is quite a violent collision. So we're really probing the strong field regime here. And the great thing about binary black hole mergers is that they emit gravitational waves that we can observe here on Earth. And specifically, one thing that I want to make sure we're all aware of in terms of terminology is usually when we talk about a binary black hole collision, I guess. We think about it in three parts. There's the in spiral, where the black holes are going around each other. There's the merger, when they come together to form, it's slicing dependent, but you know, for ultimately one black hole. And then the ring down, where this final black hole settles down eventually into a stationary state. So those are just some terms we're going to carry with us. But the fantastic thing about gravitational waves, oh, and I should mention, here on this axis is the strain, which is a unitless quantity that basically measures the amount that, you know, space-time is stretched and squeezed compared to a characteristic length scale. So you can see these numbers are quite small. And so, you know, gravitational waves are kind of weak and hard to detect. But the great thing is we are able to detect them. And so here, for example, is GW5914, the first observed detection by the LIGO interferometer shown here. And indeed, we have this way now of really seeing information from a binary black hole merger. And so potentially these binary black hole systems, gravitational waves from binary black hole systems, could contain beyond GR signatures, could, you know, contain evidence of the fact that they probe the strong field regime and potentially require, you know, these quantum gravity corrections. So, you know, indeed, there's this serious effort within the LIGO-Virgo scientific collaboration and also, you know, external people to look for beyond GR physics with gravitational waves. And so right now, this is kind of done in sort of two flavors of tests. So the first is null tests, where you basically take the gravitational wave strain that you have in the detector and you fit it with what are known as gravitational wave templates taken from predictions from general relativity. So numerical relativity is really our best way of producing these gravitational wave predictions within general relativity. We take those predictions, we match them against the data, and then we look at the residual and we make sure that the residual is consistent with noise. And this is a null test in the sense that general relativity is your null hypothesis and you're placing constraints on, you know, the validity of your null hypothesis. There are also parameterized tests, where basically what you do is you, in one kind of flavor of parameterized tests, what you do is you introduce deviations to the morphology of the waveform that you're going to compare against the data. And you leave these to be fairly general. So you just kind of introduce a functional form without thinking about specific theories. You introduce a functional form. You know, this is governed by some parameters. And what you do is you take your data and then you place constraints on these parameters. So here's the deviation of these parameters from their values in general relativity. This is on real LIGO data. And you can see that they're able, you know, in theory and in practice, to constrain these parameters. One flavor of test that's missing in this picture is model-dependent tests, where in the same spirit that you do the null test with general relativity, you have binary black hole merger waveforms in a theory beyond general relativity that you then compare against the data as your, let's say, underlying model, right? You say, you know, I think this theory of gravity is correct. I'm going to compare it against the data and sort of see what we get. And this is presently missing because we are missing waveform predictions for theories beyond general relativity. And, you know, since we're missing these gravitational wave predictions to then compare against the data, you know, let's make them, you know, how hard could this possibly be? And so we're going to, again, work within the field of numerical relativity, which is, you know, really solving the equations governing the behavior of space-time. You know, in this case, for supercomputers, you ultimately need those. But, you know, you're really solving the equations in the full strong field region. You're really, you know, you're really dealing with metrics and what's going on, you know, right near the black holes and around. And, you know, from your simulations, you get out a prediction for the gravitational radiation. And so really what we want to do is start working within this field of numerical relativity beyond general relativity. And so, you know, I mentioned that what we really want to do are our model dependent tests. And so in order to do this, we need a model, right? And so when people think about quantum gravity, you know, some buzzwords that they throw around in terms of a quantum theory of gravity are, for example, string theory and loop quantum gravity. Now, if I told you, simulate me a binary black hole merger in string theory, you know, it's kind of uncertain how to proceed in doing something like that. So instead, what we're going to do is we're going to think about what are known as beyond GR effective field theories. So here, what basically happens is you take the Einstein-Hilbert action of general relativity. So here, just, you know, given by the Ricci scalar, I've dropped like all of the constants. And this is, you know, in vacuum. And basically what you do is you treat it as the first term in a high in a series where you have, you know, various orders in curvature. So what I'm saying is that, you know, the Einstein-Hilbert action is just the first term in what is otherwise an expansion and curvature. Now here I've drawn a script R to indicate a, you know, curvature term, you know, a quadratic curvature term. So this can potentially be, you know, the Ricci scalar squared, the Ricci tensor, you know, contracted with itself, the Riemann tensor contracted with itself, the Riemann tensor contracted with its dual, and so various and various combinations thereof. But the key thing here is that, you know, in this order in the series, you have terms that are quadratic in curvature, and then you can go higher order like cubic in curvature, etc. And indeed, each order, because, you know, we're working in a series, is governed by some coupling parameter that is zero in general relativity. And then, you know, is small enough that in theory, you have a, you know, your higher order corrections are small. And the key here is that these terms that you add on to the action are motivated by quantum theories of gravity. So these are classical terms, but they're meant to encompass underlying quantum gravity effects. They have motivations in string theory and loop quantum gravity, for example. And I should mention that, you know, if you write this a certain way, this parameter will have dimensions of length, which is basically corresponds to the scale below which quantum gravity effects become important. It corresponds to, you know, in some language, like the cutoff of your effective field theory. And so in our case, we're going to work in what are known as quadratic gravity theories. So we're going to consider the Ricci scalar, so that the Einstein-Hilbert action of general relativity, plus these quantum gravity motivated classical second order curvature corrections. And so I'm going to talk about two specific theories. The first of which is known as dynamical Trin-Simons gravity, which has motivations in string theory and loop quantum gravity. And the quadratic curvature term that appears also has some motivation in models of inflation. And so what happens here is that the first term in the action for this theory is, again, the familiar Einstein-Hilbert action of general relativity. Then you have this quadratic curvature term. This is known as the Pontryagin density, and it's the dual of Riemann contracted with itself. I mentioned that, you know, in order to treat this as part of an expansion and curvature, you need this length scale here, which is precisely this L, which is zero in general relativity. And then as you sort of ramp up the value of L, you know, you're really introducing these beyond GR corrections. Now, the thing about this is that this will just integrate out of the action unless you make it kind of dynamical by coupling it to a scalar field. So here I have a scalar field. This is actually a pseudoscalar, because this term is parity odd. And so in order to preserve having a parity even action, you know, this has to be parity odd as well. And then you also introduce a kinetic term for the scalar field into the action. So we kind of have these three pieces, right? We have the GR term, then we have this, you know, quantum gravity motivated correction. And then we have the, you know, stress energy tensor for the scalar field. Just due to the fact that we had to introduce this coupling to really make this theory dynamical. And in a similar spirit, there's also people think about Einstein-Dilthey-Gauss-Bonnet gravity, which has, again, motivations in string theory and loop quantum gravity. And the way that this theory looks is quite similar. So you have, again, the Einstein-Hilbert action of GR. You have now your quadratic curvature term is known as the Gauss-Bonnet scalar. So you have Riemann contracted with itself, Ricci contracted with itself, and Ricci scalar squared. You have a coupling parameter, which in the literature is known as alpha. And so square root of alpha has dimensions of length. And again, is the scale below which quantum gravity effects become important. You have a coupling to a scalar field. There are various forms that in theory this can take, and there's a lot of literature about this. And then you have a kinetic term for the scalar field. Before we kind of proceed to talking about binary black hole systems and mergers and these theories, let's sort of talk about things that are known about these theories. So the first thing is, in dynamical Trin-Simons gravity, Schwarzschild is a solution of the theory. That's because this quantity, right, the quantity that really introduces the beyond GR modification, vanishes on a spherically symmetric spacetime. And so you don't get any beyond GR contribution there. You have nothing, you know, sourcing these beyond GR corrections. And so Schwarzschild is a solution. However, Kerr is not, Kerr with non-zero spin is not. As soon as you introduce spin, as soon as you give some rotation to a black hole, in this theory, it's no longer a Kerr black hole. Its metric is different from that of a Kerr metric. And in Einstein-Dilthey-Gauss-Bonnet gravity, this term, the quadratic gravity, the quadratic curvature term, does not vanish on a spherically symmetric spacetime. And so both Schwarzschild and, you know, the metric for a rotating black hole are modified. So neither Schwarzschild nor Kerr is a solution. And this is fantastic because, you know, in theory, if you have a single black hole, you can already, you know, and you have a way of probing the metric of that black hole, you know, or the geometry of the spacetime around it. In theory, you can, you know, already place constraints on these theories just for a single black hole spacetime. Now, I mentioned this scalar field. And so around a stationary black hole in dynamical Trin-Simons gravity, the leading order profile of this pseudo-scalar field for dynamical Trin-Simons gravity is that of a dipole. And in Einstein-Dilthey-Gauss-Bonnet gravity, the leading order profile of the scalar field is a monopole. And in DCS, these two dipoles going around each other in a binary black hole system are going to source quadrupolar radiation in the scalar field. And these two monopoles in Einstein-Dilthey-Gauss-Bonnet gravity are going to source dipolar radiation in the scalar field. Now, we don't have a scalar field detector. We don't have a way of detecting scalar field radiation. Like, why is this important? Well, it's important because the fact that you lose energy to the scalar field, that's going to modify the dynamics of the black holes. And so you're actually going to get corrections in the in-spiral, gravitational waveform or strain of the binary black hole system due to the fact that you're losing energy to the scalar field. And indeed, because in Einstein-Dilthey-Gauss-Bonnet gravity, you at leading order have this dipolar radiation, you have a negative one PN correction to the gravitational wave strain or dynamics in terms of, talking about the sort of space-time sector here. And so really what this means is that in EDGB, in this theory, you can already place, you know, quite good constraints from just binary pulsar observations. Because, you know, for the whole Taylor pulsar, for example, you're able to, you know, actually go to some post-Newtonian order, you know, you can already place these types of constraints. Now in dynamical Trin-Simons gravity, this comes at a second post-Newtonian order correction. And so what this means is that you need to, this is kind of a lower order effect. And so you really need like a strongly gravitating system in order to be able to detect these deviations. Now, let's discuss we've done. Oh, yes.
There's a question.
Quick question. As you mentioned, because of these differences, you could in principle constrain things with observations, but that assumes that in these theories, you're able to form these objects, which we have yet to establish, right?
So people have done work on, people, including myself, have done work on the question of like the stability of these objects. So let's say you have a metric that corresponds to that of a black hole in these theories. So, you know, something that has, you know, so a horizon, let's say, you know, that in like a linearized case, let's say, has been shown to be stable in the sense that, you know, you introduce some perturbation, it dies away, you know, you have this stationary object that is described by a modified metric that's different from the Kerr spacetime. Now, if you're talking astrophysically in terms of, you know, really if you have some sort of like stellar collapse, just even in general relativity, you know, this question of are the remnants of, you know, stellar collapse or, you know, primordial black holes and stuff like that, are these things really black holes? And that's a question that has been studied a lot where people consider, you know, exotic compact objects. And so, you know, whether, you know, if you were to do something like, you know, stellar collapse in these types of theories, you know, whether that would form black holes, you know, that's kind of, you know, nobody's really done that as far as I know. People have done like, you know, supernova in other scalar tensor theories, I think. But in terms of, yeah, I mean, this assumes that black holes exist in these theories and that, you know, potentially, and that these things are astrophysically relevant. Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Can I make a comment before you start?
Yes.
In spite of what Shanika said, that GR has to be right, there are two mysteries in astrophysics cosmology called dark matter and dark energy. And some physicists believe that since we haven't detected dark matter particles, it's possible that classical GR has to be modified. One of those people is me. I have this theory called STVG or MOG, and I've published solutions, Schwarzschild-like Kerr solutions, exact solutions with one free parameter. So it's possible that classical GR still has to be modified in this respect for strong gravity.
Yeah, and you know, I should mention, you know, also that people think about, you know, this is really considering modifications to gravity in the high energy regime. But, you know, people also think about lower energy modifications, such as, for example, you know, how you get these like characteristic galactic like rotation curves, which is, you know, involves some kind of perhaps like lower energy corrections, or not even corrections, like just rethinking the whole theory. And so, yeah, people think about modifying gravity or thinking about gravity beyond general relativity and testing general relativity on a variety of scales and energy regimes. You know, there are people who think about like cosmology. There are people who think about like galactic dynamics. But here, you know, we're really focused on this, you know, strong curvature regime because we are thinking about these, you know, high energy corrections. Okay, so. One thing that we've kind of done is produce, in a sense, the first binary black hole mergers in these higher curvature theories of gravity. And so broadly, this is all done numerically, and I'll talk about the caveats of this as well, in what's known as an order reduction scheme. So when you write down the equations of motion in, let's say, dynamical Chern-Simons gravity, it's unknown whether these equations are well posed. Now, this doesn't kill the underlying quantum theory of gravity because, you know, it's kind of an artifact of how you wrote down this effective field theory. But one thing that we can kind of do is that we know that deviations from general relativity are small, just, you know, by virtue of like the first LIGO detections, for example. And so what we can do is we can take the equations of motion in dynamical Chern-Simons gravity or Einstein-Dilettante-Gauss-Bonnet gravity, and we can perturb them around general relativity. And so we kind of go order by order when doing simulations like this, where we take a binary black hole background in GR, which we've known how to simulate for over 15 years now. The curvature of this background, right, we're talking about these quadratic curvature terms, sources the leading order beyond GR scalar field, right, this scalar field that's necessary to make these theories dynamical. And then this scalar field stress energy tensor plus the curvature of the GR background, well, shouldn't say plus because that's like mathematical, like, and the curvature of the GR background together source the leading order correction to the metric, the leading order beyond GR correction to the metric. And this is really what we're after because this is what's going to give us the leading order beyond GR correction to the gravitational radiation, right? Where we're after these gravitational waveforms and theories of gravity beyond general relativity so that we can do model dependent tests. And this is what's kind of going to give us this leading order correction. And the other nice thing about this scheme is that it's scale invariant. So if I do one simulation in the same way that, you know, numerical relativity in GR is invariant of a total mass, you know, here this is also invariant of a total mass, which, you know, to your point, John, you know, you can use this on a variety of scales, you know, if you wish. And then it's also independent of the beyond GR coupling parameter. So provided some caveats, which I will discuss. and so in theory, you do one simulation and you basically have your leading order beyond geometric correction with this parameter scaled out. And then you kind of reintroduce it when you actually want to do, you know, some astrophysics. And the technical details of all of this are available in these papers. And so if you want a bunch of equations, you know, feel free to reference, you know, to go into those. But I'm not going to get too technical. I'm really going to focus on the fact that we have these waveforms, talk about one of the things that we've learned. These papers, in addition to being technical, each one kind of has like a science bonus. So, you know, one talks about black hole shadows, one talks about black hole quasi-normal modes. But here, you know, I'm just going to focus on one of the things that we've learned. And then also just briefly talk about like what's to come in the coming decades. And so in order to do this simulation, right, we need to think about what, you know, binary black hole parameters to simulate. And so one thing that we can do is turn to GW150914, which was the first LIGO gravitational wave detection. It's nice because it was also one of the loudest. Now I mentioned I mentioned the fact that what we really want are higher curvature systems. So certainly, you know, you would want lower black hole masses, right, to be able to have these higher curvatures in order to have a better chance of seeing any sort of beyond GR effects or being able to place stronger constraints. But we kind of rolled with GW1509 and 14 because so many, you know, tests of GR have been performed with this system, and also because it is quite loud. Now, this is a system where we picked spins that were black hole spins and a black hole and a mass ratio that were consistent with GW1509-14. And this system, again, I mentioned that the total mass scales out when doing the simulations, but when reintroducing parameters and actually giving them units, you know, this thing has a total mass of around 68 solar masses. And so indeed we've sort of done this. We've produced the first binary black hole merger waveforms in these higher curvature theories of gravity. So here, for example, is in dynamical Trin-Simons gravity, the gravitational radiation. Now this has the mass scaled out. I'll show on the next slide what happens when you actually reintroduce G's and C's and a mass scale. But what you can already see is that for various values of the coupling parameter, you start to get deviations away from the GR waveform. So here in dashed black is the waveform that you get for a GW1509-14 like system in GR. And then as you scale this parameter up, you know, you get these deviations. One thing that I should mention is if you remember the action of the theory that I showed, you know, this came up as L squared. And if you remember the structure of the order reduction scheme, the leading order correction to the metric comes in as L to the fourth. So in this case, you know, the when you vary this number, right, what you really care about, you know, that the thing that's going to set the strength of the beyond GR effect is L to the fourth. But here, you know, I've just shown L. I see Luis has a question.
Yeah, so here you're aligning the waveforms at T equal minus whatever, 70 or something. So you assume that they hadn't been already secular effects that were already drifting for this case. You're saying at T equals zero, whatever, or at my initial thing, they are all coincident and they carry things forward?
Okay, so I'm gonna talk in a few slides about secular effects and how we can make sure that we're minimizing secular effects. In this case, yeah, for the purposes of this figure, what I did was I think aligned them by peak strain. So this is just, this is the real part of 2-2 mode of Psi-4. And so I took the absolute, you know, the absolute value of the strain and, you know, align these things. But, you know, absolutely you have, you do have this secular potential drift. And just to kind of start off this discussion, this is because in the order reduction scheme, you don't correct for the locations of the black holes due to these beyond GR effects. You know, you're still in spiraling for the black holes, the black holes as governed by general relativity without back reaction. If you were doing back reaction, then you'd be solving things in the whole theory, which we don't know how to do because, you know, your equations of motion have like third derivatives of the metric and stuff like this. And so—
But then I understand, so you pick the peak of the waveform, you align there and then so the chips fall, whatever. So that's fine. So that's also at least some part of the problem. So even if we were doing the full problem, if you knew how to do the whole everything, you would still suggest, oh, let's align at peak, just because that's a good milepost, and then see where discrepancies are.
Well, so in order to really see discrepancies, I'm going to talk about what happens when we put these through a LIGO data analysis pipeline. You know, when you put these through a real LIGO data analysis pipeline, they're going to do the peak shifts for you, right? They're going to say, they're going to give you for free a phase parameter and also a T-peak parameter. And so here, this is just kind of for the illustrative purposes of this figure that I've placed the waveforms like this. I don't think they're optimally aligned here in this peak. Actually, they might be. I forget. But, you know, at least when you put them through data analysis pipelines, they do optimally align them to maximize or to minimize the mismatch. Yeah. So here we're not making any physics claims. This is just kind of showing you what these waveforms look like. But then when I'm going to show some data analysis results with this, you know, there you are doing the full proper thing where you're realizing that you have this freedom of a phase shift, you have this freedom of a time shift, and so you're minimizing over all of that. Yeah.
Thank you, Masha. That was great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I see Reeve has a question.
So I really like this plot. I think it's great. The one thing that I noticed is that as the parameter is increasing, it seems like the waveform is only ever evolving faster. Like the pink line sort of, you know, reaches its peaks before the dashed line, and, you know, the blue line is in between them. So is that always the case just because you're losing energy, or can the back reaction ever slow down the in spiral, if you know what I mean?
Oh, that's a good question. Naively, I would say that you're always going to in spiral faster. And you know, you do get this 2PN order correction. And I think that, but that's a good question. You know, if we studied binaries in the full theory, you know, it would be really interesting to make sure that we have similar behavior. But yeah, to understand, we don't know what happens in the full theory. Just very naively, I would say that, you know, you wouldn't spiral faster. But yeah, sorry, that was unsatisfying.
No, that's great. Thank you.